daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Chinese President Xi Jinping calls for Chongqing to write its own chapter in advancing Chinese modernization. Police have arrested students in several top U.S. universities amid widespread pro-Palestinian protests. The UK government's effort to send migrants to Rwanda has won approval in Parliament. Welcome to World Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. Chinese President Xi Jinping has urged Chongqing to further deepen reforms and opening up across the board and constantly write its own chapter in advancing Chinese modernization. President Xi Jinping was speaking during his inspection tour in a municipality in southwest China. Earlier, the president chaired a symposium focusing on advancing development in China's western region. He urged efforts to foster high-quality development and boost the region's overall strength and capabilities in sustainable development. Now, for more details, we're joined by Dr. Yao Shujie, Changkang Professor of Economics at Chongqing University. Thank you, Dr. Yao. It's good to have you back on the show. Dr. Yao, you've lived in Chongqing. Why do you think the Chinese leadership has chosen this place to organize a meeting on the development of China's West?
Yeah, President Xi Jinping has paid a lot of attention to Chongqing. Actually, since the 18th Party's Congress, this is the third time he visited Chongqing. Each time, he always has some expectation about how Chongqing could be developing into an economic powerhouse. And this time, I think he called for the meeting of the Western leader of Western provinces and cities to come to Chongqing. The signal is very clear. First of all, I think Xi Jinping is very concerned about the Western development to see the potential could be fully, exploited. And certainly, I mean, Chongqing is the leading economy engine of the Western development of the country. Not only play a pivotal role of the Chongqing-Chengdu Twin City Economy Circle on the upper ranges of the Yangtze River, where the location is very important. And Chongqing itself has been developing very quickly. On average, the gross domestic product in Chongqing is always higher, on average, always higher than the national average. And also one of the highest growth rates in the western part of the country. For example, like the first quarter this year, Chongqing developing very well. They called it 6.3% of GDP growth, which compared to the country's 5.3%. And, it's not because of Chongqing is so good. It's because Chongqing have been fully utilized the local competitive advantage, the natural resources, the local industry. Actually, China has 41 big, category of industry, and Chongqing has 39. So Chongqing by province is probably the most complete industry system in the country and also in the world. So it has a great potential to become a manufacturing, high-end manufacturing hub in the world. So this is some sort of expectation that Chongqing can continue to become a very strong and dynamic economy itself, but also leading the Chongqing-Chengdu twin economy circle as well as the western part of the country as a whole. So this is a very high, expectation for Chongqing in the future. But of course, it reflects the advantage of Chongqing, what Chongqing can do
Well, talking about that, Dr. Yao, to implement, you know, the Chinese modernization, what industries, in your opinion, should Chongqing focus on?
Well, Chongqing have a fairly clear blueprint of how to develop the city economy. It called the 3-3 six strategy.
Three three one six.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The 3 trillion industrial system, and the 3.5 trillion industrial system, mm-hmm. and 100 billion industrial output system.
Wow, that's very ambitious, right?
Yeah, it's fairly comprehensive.
Mm.
For example, the most important is the first three. The first three, which would be automobile, computer, software, flat panel, and also regulated electronic product.
Mm.
And now it's the high-end manufacturing, which is also emerging to be a very important and leading pillar. It used to be just 2, and now it becomes 3.
Mm.
And more importantly, you have the other 3, half a trillion new emerging industries, and also 100 billion industries. So that means the industrial development is the key element of the Chongqing economy.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, in the symposium discussing how to advance the development of China's large western part, President Xi Jinping encouraged this part to develop a new quality productive forces based on their own conditions, local conditions. Professor Yao, in your observation, which provinces or cities have such potentials and in what areas?
You mean the city or area in the western part or the whole country?
Yes.
The whole country?
In the west part of China.
Oh, in the western part. Okay. Mm. Because the whole country, it will be fairly comprehensive. But the western part is slightly limited. But I believe even the less developed provinces or regions, they have the potential to do so. Because, fitting the local competitive advantage in local conditions, new quality productive forces, they could be everything.
Mm.
Why we call new quality productive forces is in contrast to the traditional production forces. Because the new quality is emphasized on technology, emphasized on green development, emphasized on digital and automation. Actually nowadays, almost every city, every province, they have adoption of this new technology, although they are different size and different quality.
Mm.
And this depends on the research and innovation and application of technology, the ability of the local. So Chongqing is certainly picked up to be the number one, I think.
Mm.
And Chengdu and Xi'an.
Mm.
And next is probably Kunming and Anning, and probably in Lanzhou, yes. All those places, they have a fairly strong scientific research innovation.
Mm.
And nowadays, even in Xinjiang, I think Xinjiang have a relatively few people, but they have a huge territory. It means that agriculture, tourism, and also some sort of resources, polar power, wind power, those places, they have a huge potential, including Qinghai.
Mm.
So new quality productive forces, for example, even the least developed place like Qinghai, Gansu, and in Mongolia,
mm.
Xin, Xinjiang, their advantage is that they have huge territory and they have few people, so there is a unique condition for them to develop this new, you know, this new energy, electricity power. And China, you know, the largest electricity producer in the world.
Mm.
China is the largest manufacturing country. It accounts for 1/3 of the global manufacturing output. And if China continues to be so, the requirement for electricity will keep going up. And the electricity we cannot depend on fossil fuel.
Indeed.
Because it will be highly polluted. It contradicts to the green development idea. And also so, China may not be able to afford.
So this will mean that that will be opportunities for places in the West, as you have mentioned. Thank you, Professor Yao. That was Dr. Yao Shujie, Changkang Professor of Economics at Chongqing University. Coming up, police are arresting students in several top U.S. universities amid widespread pro-Palestinian protests. This is World Today. We'll be right back.
Hello, my name is Alessandro Golombievski Teixeira. I'm a professor of public policy and management at Tsinghua University in Beijing. I am a great listener of The World Today. In my opinion, The World Today is one of the best China radio programs. In The World Today, we can get the best news and analysis in what is happening now in the world. So please, come to join us.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Police have arrested students at several top U.S. universities. Students calling for an end to the war in Gaza have set up encampments in a show of solidarity with Palestinians while demanding their universities back a ceasefire and divest from companies with ties to Israel. Police have made hundreds of arrests at Columbia, Yale, and New York universities over the past few days. Sally Patterson has more.
Hundreds of people have gathered here in Washington Square Park in a walkout of NYU students. On Monday, things came to a head outside Stern Business School around the corner from where we are. And in response, the university has been hard at work to mitigate a repeat, putting up barriers around the campus. Now, an NYU spokesperson said many of those involved weren't actually students and they didn't have authorization from the university. Protesters here say they held a non-violent protest demanding a ceasefire in Gaza amid the ongoing humanitarian crisis there. But NYU says they witnessed disorderly and antagonizing behavior which threatened the safety and security of the community. When protesters refused to leave, the New York Police Department were called and 150 arrests were made. Officers said students became violent and threw bottles. It's a scene we've seen playing out across campuses around the United States. 45 protesters arrested at Yale University on Monday after demonstrators refused to leave the area. More than 100 people have been arrested at Columbia since pro-Palestinian groups began occupying the grounds last week. The college says it will continue to support individuals' right to freedom of expression, but student safety has to be prioritized. Meanwhile, New York Mayor Eric Adams and U.S. President Joe Biden have condemned anti-Semitism on campus in recent days. Asked about the incidents on Monday, President Joe Biden said he, quote, condemns the anti-Semitic protests, but he also condemns those who don't understand what's going on with Palestinians.
Sally Patterson with the report. For more, I talked to Edward Lehman, legal affairs commentator and managing director of Lehman Lee and Xu Law Firm. Stop. How do you comment on the scale and also significance of these protests?
You know, the protests that we're witnessing represent a significant exercise of constitutionally protected rights to free speech and assembly. That's in the U.S. Constitution. So their scale underscores the depth of the public sentiment and the urgency with which certain issues are being addressed. Beyond immediate grievances, these demonstrations serve as a poignant reminder of the ongoing dialogue between citizens and their governing institutions. So, you know, these are not new, these protests certainly, but it's obviously reached a higher level pitch than ever before. And this activity is constitutionally protected. So it should continue, certainly.
Mm. Well, the discussions on U.S. policy on the Israel-Hamas conflict has always been there on university campuses across the United States. But why did these university students eventually decide to go out and protest?
Yeah, I mean, there's different answers, I guess, for that from different perspectives. But certainly mine is that university students, as citizens and members of academic communities, are exercising their fundamental rights to engage in political expression and advocacy. So their motivations, I believe, I guess, are rooted in a commitment to civic duty. That's where everyone's entitled to say what they want, and a recognition of the power of collective action in affecting societal change. So we saw this with apartheid. You know, some of this started, we saw it with the Vietnam War. Some of this started at university campuses. And we're also seeing it now in this era with that. So trying to affect societal change. These protests symbolize the convergence of academic inquiry, social consciousness, and a participatory democracy. You know, people may or may not like them, but they're entitled to do them. I mean, within reason, of course.
Mm. How much have these protests to do with, you know, the students are actually running out of patience to see the U.S. Modify its policy on the Israel-Hamas conflict? Because a lot of these students are actually asking some of their academic staff on university to divest their financial interests, which were previously linked to, you know, the Israeli side.
That's exactly what we saw, certainly with apartheid, the protesting that was happening around the apartheid era in South Africa to change that system to the current system that it is today. And so that's where you hit people where the pocketbook is, not necessarily with the protests, which are relatively small. The recent one was in Barnard College at Columbia University, near Columbia University. Mm. And there were arrests made there. But when the boards of directors or the board of trustees of these institutions, they have an endowment. So, for example, University of Notre Dame has an $18 billion endowment. Harvard University has a larger endowment even than that. Other universities like the Catholic University of America have about $276.6 million in endowment. Mm. And it's a relatively small school. So that endowment money is used by trustees or the caretakers of that money. And is given to certain financial institutions to be able to put investments wherever it is. So that's what they're speaking about now, is saying, we're going to deprive you of, you know, of giving certain of monies towards anything that would favor the Israel over Hamas. And so that's where they're trying to affect change. But university authorities are tasked with a very delicate responsibility, certainly, ensuring the safety and security of the campuses while trying to represent or, you know, recognize their constitutional rights of their students. So I think that this idea of trying to institute some changes at a board level or the endowment level would have much more impact. And I guess that's what they're going. But contrary to that, there's also a very large pro-Israeli, pro-Jewish lobby within these organizations as well and represented in the organizations. And this is where it's been very touchy, because certainly in the former ones, there weren't many apartheid, representatives at universities. There weren't many folks, there were Vietnamese that were within these communities before. And this is where it's become very poignant and very different from the past kind of issues.
Mm. What are the arguments, the main arguments from university authorities to issue warnings and also bring in police?
Yeah, I mean, the university is charged with what they call loco parentis, which is, I mean, it means you're kind of the parents, and you have to institute in sort of figuratively speaking, but as a university, you have to make the place safe for everyone. So what they're leaning back on is they're recognizing the right of freedom of expression. But in the particular instance in New York, for example, where they made those arrests, they were on the campus of Barnard College, and they were on a public space, and they said, hey, you can't put tents here. So there are all kinds of regulations about fire and safety and that type of thing. And so they're saying that the safety of the students in general, or the safety of the student body, is an important factor in allowing or not allowing these demonstrations. So that may take the right. So that what they're saying is, you know, the response often hinges on considerations of public order, campus integrity. That's what they were saying in this particular case, and the mitigation of potential disruptions to academic activities. So certainly while you're out protesting, you're not attending class. Within the framework of lawful regulation, you know, the university can strive to strike a balance between fostering an environment of conducive to free expression and maintaining institutional stability. So that's what they're trying to do. What they, in that particular case, just so everybody understands it, is that they were arrested, they were ticketed essentially, so they were removed from the property, and then they were allowed back to their university. So it's not like they're, you know, in prison for even overnight or in jailed for even a night. They're, it's actually a misdemeanor and not any kind of felony to be able to for the students, and it really probably won't hopefully affect them to go on to graduate school or other types of things in their life.
Dr. Lehman, these universities are elite schools in America. They certainly have a lot of influence on American public opinion. But does the split in university student opinion on the Israel-Hamas conflict reflect similar split among America's general public?
You're right. I mean, the Israeli-Hamas conflict is kind of a complex geopolitical issue. And the average American is not really in tune to even probably where these places are located. But it elicits a spectrum of opinions for sure. And the perspectives, you know, both within the general public or you might, which is different than universities. I mean, only about 20% of all Americans, I mean, get a university degree. Some people attend university, only about 20% graduate, even from an associate degree. So university communities are kind of different than the general public. The general public is probably, would be, I would imagine, be less informed than the university. While there may be parallels in terms of, you know, divergent viewpoints with what's happening at universities, it's important to recognize that you know, the multifaceted nature of public discourse and a myriad of factors that shape individuals' beliefs are not really out there with the general American public. So it's really hard to say where the average American person, because they don't really have a dog in that fight necessarily. Mm. On the university campuses, it's a much more culturally diverse place where these issues are first and foremost. So, I mean, sure, there is a split, but there is in the general public as well, but I don't think it's quite as acute because they don't necessarily see a you know, burning issue that impacts the average American doing their daily job. They probably don't really understand it as much.
Dr. Lehman, will these protests affect change? I mean, will the White House or the Congress think about their policy on the Israel-Hamas conflict?
Well, I think that there has been some change affected by it. I do think that there's good, bad, or indifferent. I mean, they are not immune. That remember, these both of these groups have very powerful lobby interests. So lobbyists are governmental insiders, and they advocate, you know, our representatives. There are 435 in the Congress. There's 100 in the Senate. And I think, you know, the majority leaders of both of those houses and the minority leaders of those houses have been in some way, shape, or form touched by this. I mean, in a positive way, in a negative way, through special interest groups. So there will be change. There's no question about that. How it's going to sit with the general public and is completely unknown. Mm-hmm. And the problem with it is I'm not so sure that all the representatives are necessarily in touch with their constituents. So, for example, I mean, certainly Ilhan Omar, you know, who is from the state of Minnesota, I mean, she would be, her ideas would be pretty apparent of where she sits with pro-Hamas. On other people, you know, they might appear that they're pro-Israel, but maybe they're not at all because they've got lobbyists going in the other direction. But to answer your question very directly is there will be change, and it will come from the federal government, it will come from state governments and city governments, and it will be in the form of legislation. Whether people like it or want to follow it will be another thing.
Edward Lehman, legal affairs commentator and managing director of Lehman Lee and Xu Law Firm. This is World Today. We'll be right back after a short break.
Elaf Ellard, economics professor and member of the Data Science and AI Center at New York University, Shanghai. On the World Today program, you can find in-depth and impartial insight, as well as critical commentary on key trends in the Chinese economy, financial technology, business, and blockchain. To prepare for the world tomorrow, join me on World Today.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. China's State Council has stressed the need to improve the function of capital markets in the country's modernization drive. Work includes building a safe, regulated, transparent, open, resilient capital market. Chinese Premier Li Qiang highlighted the need to speed up building a sound regulatory system and perfecting critical rules for listing, trading, and delisting to improve the quality of listed companies. Premier Li Qiang also stressed the need to intensify punishments for illegal and irregular behavior to safeguard the interests of investors. Meanwhile, China's financial market continued to be a preferred destination for global money managers. Recently, German insurer Allianz Global Investors obtained approval to operate as a wholly foreign-owned public fund management company on the Chinese mainland. For more, my colleague Zhao Yang spoke with Chen Jiahe, the chief investment officer at Novem RK Technologies.
Well, Chinese Premier Li Qiang called for accelerating the construction of resilient capital market to boost China's development. So, Jiahe, what signal does he send?
Well, the signal sent by the State Council would be that the central government of China is paying a lot of attention to the development of the capital market. We want a good capital market. We don't want it to just keep on rising. I mean, that's not what the market will be, but we want a healthy market that is capable of selecting the good listed companies and reward the investors who is been doing the good value investing and attracting the global capital. These are the key points of China's development of the capital market. We think that the capital market is really important to the economy. We have always emphasized that. If you look at the news, look at the papers published by the central government, you keep on saying a lot of papers and policies towards the capital market. We have never stopped about reforming and developing our capital market.
Mm. And just around 2 weeks ago, we saw the new 9 measures to further develop the capital market in a high quality manner. So what are the highlights of it? And could you elaborate more on that? And how could they improve China's capital market in the long run?
Well, if you look at these measures stated from the central government toward developing the capital market, they put out a paper every decade. So the first paper actually came out back in 2004, and the second paper came out in 2014. And now, 10 years later, we got the third paper. So basically, if you want to know how China's capital market is going to evolve in the next decade, you read this paper, you know, from the beginning to the end. It's not a very long paper. It got about, I think it's about 10,000 or 7,000 words. It's not very long. You just read it through, it tells you exactly what we're going to do with the capital market in the next decade. It's everything is in there. So if you look at this paper, it got many points. Well, you know, capital market is really huge. You've got so many things to develop. Things include like increasing the quality of listed companies, you know, regulating the trading in the market, attracting global capital to invest in China, encourage long-term and value investors in the market, you know, all these kind of detailed things has been put out in this paper. So if you want to know what China's capital market is going to be in the next decade, just read it through.
Mm-hmm. And we are seeing China's retail investor base expanding, and that investor base is also growing richer. So what do you think can be done to safeguard the interests of the mid and small investors?
Well, the mid and small investors is actually a group that is pretty you know, weak in the market compared with other professional investors, basically because they are lacking the knowledge of proper investment, you know, as a group. I would say some retail investors are really good. I met quite a few in my career. Some of them are even managing the money of a hedge fund just in their personal account. I mean, these retail investors are really good. There is a bunch of them in China. A typical one would be managing, you know, somewhere around 300 or 400 million RMB. RMB. So that's pretty much of money. They are kind of personalized the institutional investor. But if you take the retail investors as a whole, they're lacking the proper investment skill compared with the professional investors. So in order to protect the retail investors, there are many things we must do. I mean, it's about the wealth of the people. You have to pay a lot of attention to that. The first thing would be the education given to the retail investors, the small investors. We have to educate them, tell them about value investment, tell them how to read the financial statements, how to analyze the business model rather than just chasing the price. You know, every time you see the market has been going upward into a bull market, you see a lot of retail investors rushing in to buy the companies that are rising regardless of the financial statement. And the second is that we give them quite many advantage of the the investment rules, that for example with IPO per subscription they'd be able to get a bit more share, all these kind of things.
And data from HSBC shows that over 90% of the emerging market funds are starting to increase their holdings in China's stock market or A shares. Do you think there are clear signs of global capital coming back to China?
Definitely. I mean, if I am an investor, from another country, not in China, and you ask me to invest without consideration of any political pressure, I would say China is the first target that I want to choose because, it's the second largest economy in the world and it's growing so rapidly and it got a very responsible central government and it's opening to the world. It's keep on saying it's opening to the world, to the global capital. So why not invest in China? So for the smart global investors, one of the best choices that they can make is investing in the Chinese capital market. But one thing that stopped quite many the funds in the mature economies, especially North America, to invest in China, is that they get bans from their central government. Sometimes the United States government just say, okay, you are an investor, you are listing, you are based in the United States, so you are U.S. money, you can't invest in this Chinese company, you can't invest in that Chinese company. So that creates a problem because if you are managing a fund, you have like 20 stocks in China, you don't know which one will be picked by the government next day, and you have to sell. And sometimes if you are forced to sell in the market, and everyone actually knows that you are forced to sell, they'll be happy to see you dump your stocks at a very low price. I mean, we bought China Mobile back in 2020, at the time when the U.S. government forced the U.S. investors to sell in the Hong Kong market. So we were pretty happy to pick it up, and we made about 80% return on that. So that's a very bad thing. So if you are working in a matured economy, especially United States, you face this problem that you have to sell your holding, even if it's a very good company sometimes, because of the political pressure. So when we talk about funds from emerging market funds, if they are not basing in the United States, they are basing in a friendly country, they don't get political pressure, for example, in Singapore, Temasek, they'd be very happy to invest in China. I mean, if you look at what the Temasek has been saying, they got about 25% of their holdings are in China, and they got a lot of money from that, so why not?
So Tobias Prost, the CEO of Allianz Global Investors, said that China remains a long-term strategic priority for the company. So how do you see the growth in demand for diversified investment products in the Chinese market? And what does it mean for foreign financial institutions?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's not only the money that you can make from China, but Chinese market is also a large diversification for any global companies that is earning money from the global market, because there are basically a few large markets around the world: the North American market, the South American market, which is much smaller, the China's market, the rest of the Asian market, which is about the same size of China. If you combine the ASEAN countries, Japan, South Korea all together, you get about a size similar to the size of China. And you get this Western Europe market. These are basically the large markets of the world. So if you only sell products to one market, for example, you only sell things in Europe, and you get this war breaking out between Ukraine and Russia, you got a very volatile financial statement. Your business is very volatile, but if you expand into many other markets, including the Chinese market, so you get a much larger diversification. That's the importance of this.
Chen Jiahe, Chief Investment Officer at Novum Arcade Technologies. This is World Today. Stay with us.
Dashen, Haiyan, I'm back in Korea.
Home. I love you, Betty.
Love.
Remember?
Thank you.
Bing an.
Fate.
Take care.
Mitun.
What do they truly mean?
Dashen, where did you go? Dashen!
Embark on a century-long journey with CGTN Radio's latest offering. Echoes of Kulian, a gripping audio drama series inspired by real-life tales.
Has anyone heard of a Kodasha?
From unexpected encounters to heartfelt reunions, immerse yourself in a narrative of love, peace, and enduring friendship.
He's a piece of my lost childhood.
Listen to Echoes of Kulian on radio.cgtn.com and all major podcast platforms.
Bing An.
Welcome back to World Today. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. The UK government's effort to send migrants to Rwanda has won approval in Parliament. House of Lords has dropped the last of its proposed amendments to the Rwanda deportation bill, clearing the way for it to become law. The government plans to deport some of those entering the UK illegally to Rwanda as a deterrent to migrants who risk their lives in both, hoping that they will be able to claim asylum once they reach Britain. Sunak has vowed that deportation flights will begin in July. A series of court rulings have repeatedly blocked the plan, while human rights activists call it illegal and inhumane. Migrant advocates have vowed to continue to fight against it. For more details, Zhao Ying joins us in the studio. Thank you, Zhao Ying.
Thanks for having me.
Now, could you please explain the details of the new law and why has the UK government been so keen to implement this plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda?
Well, this new law will give Britain's immigration authorities power to send any asylum seekers entering the UK illegally after January 2022 to Rwanda. And these individuals can also be forbidden from ever applying for asylum in the UK. Mm. And it will apply to anyone who arrives in the UK by unauthorized means, like those who travel on a small boat or truck. And these people can be immediately sent to Rwanda to have their asylum claim processed there. And if granted refugee status, they will stay in Rwanda instead of the UK. The UK government has been keen on this plan because they argue it will deter people from making risky channel crossings in the first place. And they also see it as a way to address a backlog of asylum claims and free up resources for legitimate cases. Mm. And the UK government also claims it will disrupt the business model of human traffickers who exploit these desperate journeys. But it's also important to note that this is a controversial policy, and some argue that this is inhumane, and also there are some potential legal challenges there.
Mm. So what are the legal challenges and controversies surrounding this plan?
The plan has encountered opposition within the UK legal system. For instance, in November last year, the UK Supreme Court ruled the program unlawful and violated the European Convention on Human Rights because it said genuine refugees who would be at risk of being deported back to their home countries where they could face harm. But despite this ruling, the government just proceeded with this legislation, effectively overriding the Supreme Court's decision. And the plan has also raised red flags internationally. For instance, human rights groups and international organizations, including the UN and the European Court of Human Rights, have expressed reservations about the plan's compatibility with international human rights law. But apart from legal challenges, some also points out that it somehow resembles past British colonial practices because, forcibly sending migrants to a country they have no connection to is similar to historical forced displacements during the empire. And also, I think the UK government seems to be using Rwanda's reputation as a developing country, even mentioning the horrors of genocide to try to deter asylum seekers. And this is disrespectful and dismissive of Rwanda as a sovereign nation. And it seems that the UK views Rwanda more like a giant detention center rather than a country.
Well, Zhao Ying, there seems to be doubt about the plan's effectiveness. I mean, is there any evidence to suggest that the plan will deter people traveling across the English Channel to seek asylum?
Well, actually, no, because, you know, in fact, just hours after the legislation passed, French Coast Guard officials said at least five people, including a young child, had died attempting to cross the English Channel from France to England. So, I mean, desperation often drives people to undertake dangerous journeys, and it looks that the threat of deportation to Rwanda might not be enough to outweigh that kind of desperation. And the government claims the plan will deter people, smugglers, and break their business model. But some would argue that this could simply push smugglers to adapt their tactics. So perhaps, I think instead of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda, the UK government can focus on addressing the root causes of these displacement, like war poverty and persecution, which could be a more effective long-term strategy.
Well, the opposition Labour Party in the UK has vowed to scrap this plan if elected. I mean, how politicized has this issue become in the country?
Well, indeed, it has become a highly politicized issue that is dividing public opinion and political parties. So the Labour Party's opposition to the deportation plan aligns with its broader stance on immigration, which tends to prioritize humanitarian concerns and advocate for a more compassionate asylum policies. So this party frames the deportation plan as inhumane and incompatible with the UK's obligations under international law. And it positions itself as a defender of human rights and refugee rights. But on the other hand, the Conservative government, led by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, has defended the deportation plan as a necessary measure to deter irregular migration and maintain control over the UK's borders. Remember back in 2016, Boris Johnson made the famous pledge to take back control of the UK's borders, before Brexit. And the government actually portrays the plan as a crucial component of its broader immigration strategy, and frame this approach as tough but necessary to uphold the rule of law and protect national interests. So as we can see, the deep political divide makes it difficult to find common ground and develop a sustainable solution for managing asylum seekers.
One more thing, Zhao Ying, given the potential legal challenges and opposition from human rights groups, will it be realistic for the UK to begin the flights to Rwanda by July, as promised by Rishi Sunak?
Well, I mean, the plan may face some major challenges. For example, the European Court of Human Rights previously blocked deportation flights, and there could be legal challenges there. And a negative ruling could significantly delay and even derail the plan. And also, charities are preparing to support asylum seekers to challenge their removal to Rwanda. Furthermore, it may also be difficult to secure an airline that's willing to transport individuals to Rwanda. Although the government claims to have arranged charter flights and secured necessary infrastructures, those campaigners opposing the plan are coordinating protests against the airline and to try to pressure the airline to withdraw from the government's Rwanda scheme. So I think given these obstacles, the July deadline seems highly unlikely.
Thank you, Zhao Ying, for giving us the whole story here. This is World Today. Stay with us.
Hello, I am Dr. Digby James Wren, a political analyst and international relations scholar specializing in China area studies. World Today offers unmatched in-depth perspectives on China's politics, economics, business, technology, and society. World Today's team of reporters and contributors provides valuable information from all of the world's major economies. I hope you can join me on World Today for the very best insights and news from China, on China, and help to build a better understanding of China's role in the world today.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. China is targeting Thursday evening to launch its Shenzhou 18 manned mission to the Tiangong space station. Among the tasks for taikonauts Ye Guangfu, Li Cong, Li Guangsu is experimenting with an aquatic ecosystem in orbit. The crew is taking fish and algae to space. China Manned Space Agency Deputy Director Lin Xiqiang further explains the purpose of the project.
国内首次在轨水生生态研究项目。
Shenzhou 18 will carry out the first in-orbit aquatic ecology research program in China. Taking zebrafish and hoverworm as research objects, they will establish a stable and running space self-cycling aquatic ecosystem in orbit, achieving China's breakthrough in cultivating vertebrates in space. They will also carry out the in-orbit study of plant-tip stem cell for the first time globally, revealing the mechanism of plant evolutionary adaptation to gravity and providing theoretical support for the directed design of space crops adapted to the space environment.
The space agency says the astronauts will also conduct spacewalks and handle cargo deliveries during their six-month stay. For more, we're joined by Zhang Fan. He is Associate Professor of Astronomy, Department of Beijing Normal University. Thank you, Zhang Fan. It's good to have you back on the show.
Hello.
So, Zhang Fan, first of all, how do you comment on the lineup of this crew members on Shenzhou 18?
So all three crew members, they are born in the 1980s, so they're fairly young. The commander is actually more experienced. He belongs to the second generation of astronauts. He went up with Shenzhou 13, so he's already been up there in the space station. So he will be both the commander and sort of a teaching role. And the other two, Li Cong and Li Guangsu, they're third generation pilots. They're novices. That this is first time up. And they're both fighter pilots. All three of them are actually fighter pilots. This is a little bit unusual because we know that there are flight engineers and payload specialists among the third generation.
Mm.
The reason why they're all pilots is, I think, first of all, because there will be a very strenuous spacewalks doing difficult tasks. So you need people with good physique. And then also there's the issue of you need to train future commanders, and pilots will always be the commanders. So that's why the composition is as such three pilots.
Mm, well, that's interesting. China Manned Space Agency said Shenzhou 18 will perform a fast automated rendezvous and also docking with the radio port of the space station call module Tianhe in about 6.5 hours, forming a combination of three modules and three spacecraft. I mean, what do you think the main mission is for Shenzhou 18? And earlier we talked about, the mission of experimenting with this aquatic ecosystem, right?
Right. So this is the third launch during the so-called application and development phase, basically the regular phase of running of the space station as a national laboratory for developing science. They'll be up there for 6 months, and during which they'll do two to three spacewalks and six cargo sort of in and out operations. For the spacewalks, they will put debris shelters, shielding on the on external pipelines, cables, and other key equipment. So that's a very difficult task, very useful as well. As you mentioned, in terms of scientific experiments, one catches the eye is they'll bring zebra fish up there. Mm-hmm. So this kind of fishes have very short time span. So you can follow them during the 6 months. It's enough to follow them through their whole life cycles, and so you can have sort of see how they adapt to the different generations, that sort of thing. So quite interesting things going on.
Mm. Well, the space agency also said China's manned moon probe project is also being carried out according to the plan. Zhang Fan, how do the Shenzhou series prepare for China for the Moon Probe project.
Right. So on the moon, so China is planning to establish an international research station. So it's a station, it's on the moon, and this space station, the Shenzhou craft is ferrying people to, it's a station in space.
Mm-hmm.
They're both stations, and the environment, the lunar environment, is not too different from the space environment. So a lot of things are interchangeable. For example, in terms of the spacecraft, the capsule that takes crew over there is going to be the same as the one that's the next generation one that's used for going to space station. And the rocketry, the Long March 10 is going to be bigger, but it's based basically on Long March 5 technology. Long March 5 is for bringing a space station up, and you know, space suits and the docking capabilities, automatic docking capabilities between different modules, that's all very similar. And also there's the human element, you know, the space medicine development, you know, the studies on how the bones develop, how the muscles, especially heart muscle, behave in microgravity. That's all going to be used for the lunar mission. And also, lastly, the lunar research station will have a lot of science experiments, the same as the space station.
Uh-huh.
And the whole pipeline for different institutes collaborating, developing the payload, the standards and procedures, that's actually an aspect that's really important as well.
Zhang Huan, we have about a minute and a half to wrap up the conversation, but Wednesday marks China's Space Day. What experiences and lessons can we draw from the history of China, you know, developing its space exploration programs?
Right. If you follow the Chinese program carefully, you see that there's hardly any very high profile sort of first of mankind type of thing going very far. It's rather low profile, steady, sort of one step at a time, building on previous project, and gradually that capabilities accumulate to a point where you can do interesting things very fast now. So we're seeing this transition point, especially in terms of scientific output. So the space, the carrying the rocketry and everything, is now capable of taking really serious science experiments up all the way to the moon as well. So that's what China, it's very different from other countries, like go to the moon first, go to Mars, and then the rocketry are different, and everything has to be redone. You know, it's sort of gradual, step-by-step process going on.
Thank you, Zhang Fan. We appreciate your time and insight. That was Zhang Fan, Associate Professor of Astronomy Department of Beijing Normal University. That's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. A quick recap of the headlines. Chinese President Xi Jinping calls for Chongqing to write its own chapter in advancing Chinese modernization. Police have arrested students in several top U.S. universities amid widespread pro-Palestinian protests. The UK government's effort to send migrants to Rwanda has won approval in Parliament. For more discussions, find us on the X platform at CGTN Radio. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Thank you for staying with us. Bye for now.